Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ruben Iniguez. I represent the appellant, John Williams, in this matter. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve at least 4 minutes of my time.
You may do so, counsel. Just watch the clock.
The issue presented in this case is one of first impression in this circuit. At its heart, it's an issue which concerns federalism, namely the federal-state balance in the prosecution of crimes. Well, the federal government in this case is seeking this court's approval to extend the honest services theory under the wire mail fraud statutes to a case that this circuit has never applied before, that is, a matter that involves a transaction between purely private individuals. It is not a public corruption.
All right, we're on the 1346 issue.
Exactly, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. There is a public-private dichotomy in this line of cases with respect to the intangible right to honest services.
Counsel, haven't some other circuits held, I think the 11th and the D.C. Circuit and perhaps others, that if there's a fiduciary relationship involved or something like that, that this statute can apply between private parties?
Not with respect to the issue here, Your Honor. This circuit, in the Frege case, the most recent opinion published by this circuit with respect to this matter, approves the intangible right of honest services theory. That was a public corruption case. Now, the government cites the court to Bohonas, a pre-McNally 1980 case, which does stand for the proposition that in a corporate employee disloyalty case involving corporations and an employee, yes, the fiduciary responsibility, those fiduciary cases can be applied. But there are no cases from this circuit or other cases involving purely private individuals. Those cases all involve labor unions, corporations, employers, and employees.
Well, counsel, they're private.
Counsel, labor union. I have two questions about that.
Yes, sir.
One is, while historically the deprivation of honest services has traditionally been used in public corruption cases, the language of 1346 does not on its face make any distinction between public and private. And second, in the precedents that you cite about how it's been used, if tradition alone were enough to limit the reach of a statute, a lot of them are not public. For example, a labor union is not a government agency. So I don't get it. I'm wondering why Frege and the language of the statute isn't the end of that argument.
Your Honor is perfectly correct with respect to the history of this doctrine. And I think it's a confused one that requires, to answer the court's question, requires some explanation of the history. Now, in the 117 years of the wire fraud statute before the McNally case, this was a judicially adopted doctrine. And Judge Stevens, in his dissent, joined by Judge O'Connor, set forth the four categories that historically, in those 117 years, the courts had applied this doctrine. Two of them are public and government corruption categories. The other two are private sector categories. The fourth category has no application here, and that is the privacy cases. The Louderman case from 1978 from this circuit is a privacy case. Now, that case and those cases, those privacy cases, have been disregarded by, for example, the Rybicki and Bonk panel, noting that that's not really an honest services case. The case never dealt with honest services. It's a privacy case. The category that we're dealing with here, Your Honor, is Category 3. Yes, labor unions and corporate employees. The plain language of the statute.
I'm not sure that we are. Let's look at the language of the statute. It says, for purposes of this chapter, the term scheme or artifice to defraud includes a scheme or artifice to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. For us to accept your argument, we would have to interpret the word another to exclude private individuals. And that seems to me a grammatical stretch, a verbal stretch.
Your Honor, of course, it's elementary that we always start with the plain language I would first note that this court in Frege, 1999, the last public decision, went immediately to the legislative history, as have numerous other circuit courts, because that language requires interpretation. It is not plain on the face, and many circuits have grappled with this difficult issue of what does that mean, to deprive another, and does it mean another corporation, employee, citizen? Does it mean an individual? And courts have grappled with that issue. Because of that, this court turned to the legislative history in Frege, and I would point the court to footnote 7 at page 802 of that case, in which it discussed Senator Biden's testimony, in which he said that this bill will make it possible, once again, to prosecute and send to prison those public officials who corrupt their office.
Is there anything in the legislative history that, if we were to accept that as a sufficient basis for limiting the language, where the congressmen and senators say this will not extend the reach of the law to deprivation of honest services to individuals?
Two responses.
I mean, that Biden quote that you just gave me says, "What good boys we are, we're just wonderful. We're curing a Supreme Court error by making sure public corruption can be penalized." It doesn't say anything about avoiding extension of the statute to private fraud.
Your Honor, it not only says that it applies to public officials to reinstate that the prior doctrine, but it also says that it is now a crime again for anyone who attempts to corrupt the election process, amends the existing mail and wire fraud statutes to make clear that notwithstanding the holding McNally, it is a crime to deprive any organization, such as a corporation or a labor union, of the loyal services of its employees.
You know, so if that's what the statute said, if it said those words, then I would be inclined to apply the statutory interpretation principle of a jus stem generis and exclude individuals. But the statute doesn't say that, and it's hard for me to get it into that limitation into the word another.
Well, Your Honor, if I may then give you the second response, is it's not only that the legislative history that this court has specifically relied on in the past and other courts have relied on to interpret this section, but I would say that the fact that they're pointing out what it does apply to, there are numerous other things that it could not apply to that would be too innumerable. But what I would say this also is that the McNally case, McNally is also always cited for the proposition that the Supreme Court held that public officials can't be held accountable or penally sanctioned for depriving citizens of good government. But there were two defendants in the McNally case. McNally himself was a private individual. Gray was the public official. And if what the courts have said is that you have to go back to pre-McNally law to determine what this means. Gray itself, and I quote Gray at page 18 of my reply brief, says, and the point of this is to say that McNally reversed the circuit court's opinion in Gray and McNally. And when you then, by Congress, reinstate the prior law, which would be Gray, the Sixth Circuit's opinion in Gray, this is what the court has to say about pre-McNally law. Misconduct of a fiduciary in the administration of exclusively private matters in his capacity as a private individual, which does not involve the misuse of public office or public trust, is not actionable as a violation of the mail fraud statute under an intangible rights theory. That was pre-McNally law. Now, when Congress reinstated the law, that was what the law held.
Counsel, is there any post-McNally circuit court case that adopts the theory that you are asking us to adopt?
No. There is no case directly on point, Your Honor, with this purely private transaction. And we have to ask ourselves, why? Now, what happened in this case? If we look at the case, and that's what the government's asking you to do, to save its case. This case was originally brought under 1341 and 1343 alone. It was only when the statute of limitations 5 years later was looming and the government realized finally that its witness in this case was not competent, was not available to testify, that the government, after the complaint, after the indictment, finally filed a superseding indictment raising this theory. Why? Because it had nowhere else to go. It was stuck. And as the prosecutor himself mentioned in the district court, he'd never seen in all his time in the District of Oregon an intangible rights theory case brought. Why? Because as Judge Hogan noted, that it's always better to have direct misstatements and proof of actual fraud. The jury gets that. This simply doesn't apply. That's why there
are... Well, they had that in this case, too, as it turned out, didn't they?
As I say in my brief, Your Honor, I think I would respectfully disagree with any assertion that there was proof of actual fraud. I think, A, the prosecutor himself was admitting that he had no direct misstatements of fact. He did not. The only evidence you had, and I'm stuck with it here, unfortunately, is the video deposition, which shouldn't have come in, was not relevant. The gentleman, 5 years after the fact, was clearly, if you look at that video, incompetent. There were Crawford issues that should have been raised, right to confrontation. Without that witness, there was a stipulation by defense counsel to let it in, but without that witness, there was no case. But when we look at that, when we look at that deposition video and what he said, there are two omissions of fact that the government points to. The fact that he could not remember a joint bank account and that he could not remember the post office mailboxes. That gentleman, Your Honor, and I have a lot of sympathy for Mr. Stubbs, as you can see from that video, he couldn't remember anything. The gentleman, by that point in time, had deteriorated naturally. He couldn't remember his age. He didn't recognize Mr. Williams, who he knew. He didn't recognize other people. When asked who he would give money to, he asked the prosecutor, "You wouldn't want it, would you?" So that has stayed in mind 5 years later. This gets into the other issue of the vulnerable victim enhancement, but it's just not relevant. They had no proof of actual fraud. That wasn't the theory on which they proceeded. They proceeded on two theories. This one's invalid, and all of these, for that reason, counts should fall. With respect, going back to your question, Your Honor, no circuit courts have addressed this. But again, we have a Supreme Court case that does deal with the issue. And although it's a dissenting opinion from Judge Stevens with O'Connor joining him, that is the best summary on which many other circuit courts have relied for establishing what was pre-McNally law.
Counsel, if we were to determine, contrary to your argument, that there was sufficient evidence under both theories, and if we were further to determine that you're right about the law, what would the answer be? Would that be a reversal or a reversal for a new trial on the regular fraud theory, or what would the relief be?
If I may restate Your Honor's question so I understand it properly. If you find that they proceeded on both theories and one theory, the intangible rights theory, is invalid,
but that there was evidence to support both, that's the additional. You have argued that there's not sufficient evidence on a regular fraud theory, and my hypothetical disagrees with that assertion. So two theories, one valid, one invalid, but plenty of evidence on both. What is the proper relief?
If there are two theories and one is invalid, Your Honor, even if you found sufficient evidence of actual fraud, but you found insufficient evidence, let's say, of the honest services theory, but you found that it was invalid, as I argue, and I believe I'm looking for the case, but I believe it's either Griffin or Griffith that would require reversal on all counts because the government proceeded clearly on two theories.
But new trial or no new trial? That's what I'm trying to get at.
It would be reversed and vacated. It would have to be reversed and vacated under the Supreme Court case.
Wouldn't that lead to a new trial?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Would there not? You said something before that made me wonder if there would be a new trial. If I understood you right, you said the statute of limitations barred prosecution for taking the old man's money. So the only thing that they could prosecute for was depriving the old man of honest services. Did I understand you right?
They were, what I indicated, Your Honor, is that they were approaching the statute of limitations. The gentleman's deposition was taken.
Approaching?
Yes.
The statute of limitations is one of those things. It's not like horseshoes. You're either on the right side of it or the wrong side. Were they on the right side of it for stealing the old man's money?
They were weak on the right side. December 22nd.
A week is...
December 29th.
All right. So there's no statute of limitations.
No statute of limitations problem.
But I don't think you've answered either of my colleagues' question with respect to what is the effect of a reversal. Does that mean... double jeopardy, no new trial, or are we in effect sending it back for a new trial?
The case is Griffin that I was referring to, 502 U.S. 46, a 1991 Supreme Court case. It would require reversal and vacation of the convictions. Double jeopardy would apply. The federal government would not be able to prosecute him with new opposition. This should have been originally a state matter. This is a state matter, and those that's the state of Oregon is the appropriate and effective tool.
I don't understand why double jeopardy would bar prosecution. It seems like just a routine reversal where the jury is instructed erroneously and gets the case again.
I would respectfully disagree, Ron. I believe.
Explain it to me. Just educate me.
Well, the gentleman has been convicted of these offenses on an invalid theory. Even if, assuming that
happens whenever we have erroneous jury instructions.
Well, then if the government, Your Honor, could retry him, it could retry him on the actual fraud basis. As I say,
fraud for money rather than honest services.
Right. They would need direct misstatements of fraud, and they would need proof that there was actual property, money or property taken.
But it seems I don't understand why. Suppose we accepted your McNally theory.
Yes.
And we said, well, another doesn't include a private individual, so a prosecution for fraud by depriving an individual of honest services doesn't charge a crime. It seems to me that they could go back and charge the financial planner with fraud by stealing the old man's money and taking it to Belize.
Right. They may be able to do that. I don't know. As I say, the deposition was taken a week before the statute of limitations ran on the first relevant event. There may be a statute of limitation as to subsequent events that were after that date. I just don't know. If you're asking in terms of the extent of any other prosecution that could be forthcoming if this court reversed on this ground, I'm just not sure where we'd be on that.
Counsel, you're at below 3 minutes. You indicated an interest
Thank
in
you,
reserving
Your Honor.
Time.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Chris Cardone, and I represent the government here, as I did below in this trial. It's a pleasure to be here this morning to argue the case, and I'd like to proceed first to the nature of the questions that the court asked counsel concerning the reach of 1346. And 1346 is plain on its face. There is nothing, as this court has pointed out, limiting the application of intangible rights, the honest services theory, to corporate setting or public corruption setting. The language is plain. It's far-reaching, but it is plain.
So is it your position that any time, let's say I hire a plumber to come do some work in my house and I feel that somehow it isn't honestly done, how far does your theory go in asserting that Congress intended to cover that kind of activity?
Judge Graber, your question precisely raises the issue that several courts that have addressed this theory have asked. How far are we to go as a court? We're uncomfortable. We can see it applying in certain situations, but how far are we going to go with this?
Do we have any Ninth Circuit cases? You're referring to out-of-circuit cases?
I am. There are eight circuits, Your Honor, that have spoken on this issue unanimously. They're cited on pages 28 and 29 of my brief. None of them are Ninth Circuit cases that come after the 1346 statute was promulgated. But, Judge Graber, getting back to the question, is the government going to be able to prosecute an employee for making a long-distance phone call on the corporate dime? And courts, understandably, are very hesitant to allow the government to criminalize something like that. What the courts have done, the eight circuits that have spoken, have imposed limitations in generally three areas. First of all, they require a fiduciary relationship between the defendant and the person who was victimized. Second, the materiality requirement, picking up on the Netter case, but also in many of those cases, the court wants to know was this breach a material one or a de minimis one? And in the phone call situation, Your Honor, I would suggest to you that it would be de minimis. But also, and very critically to these cases that these courts that have spoken on, they want to know whether there was a risk of economic harm imposed in the situation. Not actual harm, but whether there was reasonably foreseeable economic risk.
Counsel, I am troubled by reaching farther than we need to. I was puzzled that the indictment even charged the financial planner with depriving the old man of honest services, since the financial planner also deprived the old man of several hundred thousand dollars. It seems like there's an easy way and a hard way, and the indictment made you responsible for the hard way. And I'm even more reluctant to reach out and issue a whole lot of dicta on plumbers and fiduciaries and employees making personal phone calls. I mean, on the one hand, you say a plumber, and I'm thinking somebody coming to fix my sink, and it's a real stretch. On the other hand, I'm thinking a car repair outfit that fixes hundreds of cars and says to people, oh, we're doing this and we're doing that to your car and fixing all these things, and they're just lying. Maybe it's warranty services, so they're actually depriving the manufacturer of money, but the customers think their cars are fixed when they're not. Waste a lot of time. It seems like some of these are real questions, and we don't need to answer them. I don't get why the jury was asked to answer the question of whether the defendant deprived the victim of honest services. Am I missing something here?
Judge Kleinfeld, the question goes to the charging instrument and why I chose the government's prosecutor to implement alternative theories.
I was hoping it was simple, like statute of limitations, but it turns out you were weak on the right side of it.
I was on the both sides of the statute, the right side on the statute in both theories. But getting a little bit outside the record and getting into my discretion as a prosecutor, the reason I chose to implement this theory is because the health of my only victim. The defense in this case, Your Honor, was this was a gift. This old man trusted me. He wanted me to have his money. That was the defense coming into trial. That was raised in the opening statement and so on and so forth. I knew that coming into trial. I also knew coming into trial the health of the only witness that I could call to say that that was not so directly was, at that point, a 92-year-old man who was clearly suffering on the way out. Knowing that, I superseded. I asked the grand jury to consider the alternative theory. We got the alternative theory, and we proceeded on it. So the reason that was part of the indictment was first is because that was a tool available, in my opinion, to the government where you have somebody with a clear fiduciary obligation to a client who abused that to steal his money. But second of all, I was concerned about the health of the victim. I didn't know.
Oh, I see. So the idea is to protect. We need the honest services to protect senile victims, so that where the prosecutor cannot show that it's not a gift, nevertheless, he can show that a fiduciary in that position cannot honestly accept gifts.
What I was grappling with.
And there's a whole class of senile people that are likely to be victims of crooks. Have I got this right now?
Well, specifically as applied to this case, yes, you do. The problem I have...
You understand why I put it that way. We can't make a decision in this case based on things that are not in the record, but the understanding that you've given me about a potential class of victims can be a basis for consideration.
Counsel.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Please finish answering Judge Kleinfeld, then I have my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The situation specifically applied, yes, you're right, on. But more generally, when you have a fiduciary relationship, whether it's a group of senile old people, to use the court's term, or a class of other people that also have fiduciary relationships with other people, stockbrokers, employees of a managerial nature, and things of the like, I wouldn't limit it to old people, but I would focus and ask this court to focus in its consideration of the 1346 application to the fiduciary relationship and the duties imposed on them, based on that.
Counsel, my question is, in a sense, a follow-up to Judge Kleinfeld's initial question, and that is, I'll pose the same thing to you that I oppose that I posed to opposing counsel. If we were to conclude, in accordance with the defendant's argument, that the theory is not valid, but we also were to conclude that there was sufficient evidence under both theories, what would happen? And if your answer is the same as his, then we can't avoid the question. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay.
And I think this court must answer the question of whether 1346 is properly in play in this case. And that is because the Griffin case, as I understand Justice Scalia's opinion from the Griffin case, that when you have two legally competing theories that go to the jury without a special verdict separating them, and there's a general verdict, then a defect in the theory, the legal theory on one of them, is going to cause an entire conviction to fall.
And that's because it's possible that the jury convicted the person of a non-crime.
Yes.
And you don't know otherwise because there's no special verdict.
That's correct.
Okay.
But Your Honor, I hope you never get there. The application 1346 is solid in this case.
My question really went to whether we could walk around the issue, and you agree with, on that point, it sounds like you both agree.
Counsel, Mr. Iniguez suggested there was a federalism issue here. Could you have brought the same indictment against the plumber? You heard the plumber example. Plumber comes into your house, doesn't fix your sink the way it should have been fixed, or charges you too much. Is there a federal indictment available? Why?
I submit not. If the court follows the strength of theory of language used by the Eighth Circuit of the direct interest decision since 1346 is accountable, the court's concern is finished just like that. You can't have the government over-criminalizing conduct.
But what's the bright line? What's the dividing line? Why is it perfectly okay to bring this case involving two individuals in the same city, same state, no assertion of interstate commerce as the theory for it? Why isn't that any different than the plumber case?
Plumber might mail his bill.
Sorry?
The plumber might mail his bill.
Yes. But as a matter of law, what I said before, we could go after the plumber if the limitations imposed by the Eighth Circuit that have spoken apply here. There's no fiduciary relationship between you and the plumber. Your plumber does not have dominion over your finances, control over you. You don't.
All right. So it's limited to employer-employee. We've got a case there. Also fiduciary relationship, but nothing beyond those two, except, of course, the public situation.
Yes, and the other limitation is materiality of the breach and foreseeable economic harm. May I address Mr. Nicholas's attempt to distinguish the private sector application 1346 being open to other circuits with an attempt to say that here we have a purely private relationship, and we're asking the court to go even further. I respectfully disagree. If the court looks at footnote 17 of the Rajani case, the Second Circuit case of recent vintage, cited in my brief, it's an en banc decision in 2003. So the Second Circuit gave this issue in full consideration. In footnote 17 of that case, the Second Circuit no difference between the employer-employee relationship and corporate situation. That is a fiduciary. It's the nature of the relationship, the duties owed, the duties that are required. They draw no distinction between employee-employer relationships and others.
I don't know if the fiduciary distinction would work in any event. That's why I'm reluctant to reach it. The fiduciary owes the beneficiary the punctilio of the highest honor, in Cardozo's phrase. He owes an especially high duty, but even a non-fiduciary probably owes a duty of honest services. If you have a cleaning lady that comes to clean your house once a week and you leave out the key and you send her a check or leave the check outside with the key under the doormat, and she comes by and takes a check and doesn't come in and clean the house, she probably owed you a duty of honest services, at least to that level of honesty, of coming in and doing some cleaning. She's not entitled to just lie to you and cheat you, even though she's not a fiduciary. She's about as far from a fiduciary as she can get.
Yes, Your Honor. But to decide this case, this court need only say that a fiduciary, not that there is necessarily required, but that where you would have a fiduciary relationship, which is so heightened, especially when you're dealing with an 87-year-old man failing emotional and physical health. When you have that type of relationship, obligations are dramatically heightened. And when one goes to the level that this man might create a secret bank account, corporate offshore accounts, and uses his powers as a fiduciary to overcome the unwilling influence, corrupt through those fiduciary powers to steal over $400,000, send it down to the police, assume a false identity, and go live on the beach. That certainly is conduct that comes within this notion of intentional right on services, and that's why this court needs to decide the permanent conviction.
Could this case have been brought under a state indictment in the state court?
I've never been a state prosecutor, so I don't know. But I will tell you this. To get the state of Oregon in this climate of funding, you need to consider a white-collar case. It's very difficult.
Well, it may not matter to our decision, but don't you think that a theft of that magnitude of a victim that vulnerable might have interested a state prosecutor?
Ask you, when you say you said it twice now, on the way out, are we talking about mental condition or physical deterioration? Obviously, you're suggesting that at least so far as these states are statements are concerned, they were lucid and knowing. But when you say on the way out, you mean that he maybe didn't have an expectancy of living much longer, or what? What? Help me with that. Mental condition was not sufficient that we should be skeptical about his responses then. If you have the citation, why don't you make out a gum sheet, which our deputy clerk will provide to you in three copies, so that everyone gets, and certainly serve your opposing counsel as well.
Very well. So my position, we never did to go beyond the statute, section 2B,
and serve.
Sorry.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Iniguez, you have some reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd first like to point out that the government here, in arguing that the statute 1346 is plain on its face, is taking inconsistent positions in this case. It should not be allowed to do so. I'd cite the court to my supplemental excerpt of record, page 5, where the government prosecutor indicates to Judge Hogan, what does intangible rights mean? Intangible right to honest services, I'm not sure that that phrase really has any common sense meaning, and that cries out for a little bit of an elaboration from this court. They're taking an inconsistent position here and should not be allowed to do so. They're also relying on what Mr. Cardani keeps referring to as 8 unanimous circuit court opinions. And I would point the court respectfully to my reply brief at pages 15 to 16, where case by case I address those circuit court opinions that he cites in his brief. None of those deals with the situation here, a private individual transaction. They are all corporate labor union kickback bribery cases or public official cases. One of them doesn't even involve...
I thought there was a lawyer case, too.
Excuse me?
Isn't there a case involving a lawyer as
yes,
well?
Yes, yes, and that case doesn't even involve... It's a wire fraud case. Nowhere refers to honest services doesn't involve intangible right theory, Your Honor. That's the Altman case that he cites.
How can we interpret the word another to mean that Congress meant to protect corporations, unions, and other entities, but not the people as individuals?
Your Honor, with all due respect, it's because the legislative history in all the courts, including the Supreme Court, to address this issue, that's the way they ruled. The case that counsel does not address, and I would respectfully ask this court to grapple with, is the Gray decision. It's 790 F. 2nd, It's the case, the Sixth Circuit case, that went up to the Supreme Court. And again, that's the language that I cited, which I think is detrimental, devastating even to the government's situation. It's saying what pre-McNally case law was: misconduct of a fiduciary in the administration of exclusively private matters in his capacity as a private individual, which does not involve the misuse of public office or public trust, is not actionable as a violation of the mail fraud statute under this theory. That's exactly what the pre-McNally law was. All the cases that the government's citing me to, these circuit court opinions that are unanimous on the same thing that this court has previously decided in Bohonas. And that is that in the employee corporate disloyalty situation, that fiduciary relationship, yes, this theory applies. That's clear. This court in Frege, it's the only decision to address the McNally, post-McNally, narrowly held after looking at the legislative history that 1346 applies to public official, public corruption cases only. If I could only say a little bit about the vulnerable victim. Your Honors, I think I would ask the court to look at that video. That's the gentleman 5 years after the fact. That is not the gentleman. There's no evidence of what he was like 5 years earlier at the time of these incidents. So it has no bearing.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and the court will adjourn.